Hello and welcome to the Farming Advice Service podcast. We recorded this podcast back in March, but have saved it to publish until now, as June 2nd is World Peatland Days. And you'll see why that's relevant in a sec. I'm Laura Harpham, I'm the Programme Manager for the Farming Advice Service, and in this podcast I'll be talking to Jordan Champ, who is a Senior Policy Advisor specialising in lowland peat with DEFRA. Jordan joins us to talk about the particular challenges and opportunities of farming on peatland soil, why we should care, and what those who are farming in peatland areas can consider to make their farm management choices more sustainable. Hello, Jordan. Thanks for joining me. Before we get into the detail, could you give us a little introduction, please, and tell us how you've ended up with this interesting specialism?
Sure. Thank you for having me. So, yeah, I joined the DEFRA team about just over 3 years ago. I personally did a biology degree, so I thought that was probably a useful place to try and put that into practice. So I joined the peat restoration team initially, which is largely focused around delivering peatland restoration back to natural habitat. So the kind of Nature for Climate peatland grant scheme is our main flagship fund, if you like. And so that's been going on for a while. So I started work on that. And then while I was doing that, the independent Lowland Agricultural Peat Task Force was going on, which brought together experts and stakeholders from around the country to come up with some recommendations around how we improve the condition of our farmed peat in lowland areas. So that kind of came to conclusion in 2023, and I moved over to the team that I'm in now to take forward action on those recommendations, targeting a bit more specifically at those kind of agricultural areas in places like the Fens and the Broads, and trying to work out solutions as to how we can improve their condition and reduce emissions whilst also keeping their agricultural productivity going for as long as we possibly can.
Good stuff. Okay, interesting. I'm particularly looking forward to talking to you today because I used to work over in the Broads. I started my career over in Norfolk, and so I have a good understanding of biodiversity opportunities, of peatland on nature reserves, and some of the incredible bird life in particular that it fosters. But I haven't really worked very much in the farming and peatland area. So I know our listeners will learn a lot today, and I'm looking forward to picking up some interesting new information as well. Having said that, I am going to start with the basics because useful for me, but also hopefully useful for others. You mentioned lowland peat as opposed to presumably upland peat. And can you just give us a brief kind of summary of when we talk about peatland, what exactly do we mean from a scientific definition perspective, and how much of England does it encompass?
Yes, right from the kind of beginning, peat essentially is a type of soil. It is characterized by its high organic content, which gives it a very dark color. And it's generally, when in its healthiest condition, is water saturated. So by weight, it should be around 80, 90% water. And you're right in saying that there is lowland and then there is upland. There is a bit of gray area in the middle ground where it's difficult to characterize, but typically lowland areas are flatter and under kind of generally more intense agriculture, either arable or for grazing livestock. And then you have upland areas, which are typically hillier and at greater altitude. So for things like the agri-environment schemes, we typically use the moorland line to distinguish between lowland and upland. And generally, there are different estimations around how much peat there is. It's quite difficult to map, particularly as kind of condition changes and the organic matter changes, and particularly the depth changes over time as well. So it can be quite difficult to map, and there is incidentally an ongoing project to produce a new England peat map, which will give us a better idea around that, which is due to be published in the spring. But there is more or less around 350,000 hectares of upland peat and around 250,000 hectares of lowland peat, which is more or less the size of the county of Dorset, to give a bit of a picture of kind of what that means, because they're big numbers. And I certainly, when I first started, I didn't know what that meant in reality. So yeah, a big challenge, but it thankfully in some ways it's focused in particular parts of the country. It gives us a better idea around where we're trying to work.
Sure. Yeah. A bit more targeted advisory work and funding, I imagine. Okay. Big numbers in terms of if you're managing it all by yourself, it would be a fairly big undertaking. But in the grand scheme of the amount of land that is managed under farmland management in the country, not huge. So next question is, why is it important enough to warrant having its own senior policy advisor and being featured on the Farming Advice Service podcast? What is so important about the management of peatland?
So peat and peatlands are really key carbon stores. They are an integral part of the net zero pathway and all of the carbon budget leading up to 2050 as well. Every 4 or 5 years or so, there is basically a marker at which point the idea is that you achieve certain emissions reductions so that by 2050 we reach net zero. And restoration and responsible management of peat soils is an integral part along that whole process because of their capacity to store carbon. Emissions from peat soils currently equate to around 2% of the total greenhouse gas emissions from England, which I think is equivalent to just over 1 million homes. So it's essentially tackling an equivalent emissions reductions to that, which in itself, considering they don't, as you say, they don't cover a huge proportion of the country, 2% of emission is comparatively quite big. There is a big opportunity really to reduce emissions and in doing so also supporting those natural habitats, that biodiversity, those specialist species that rely on peatland habitats, but then also to provide long-term viability for the agricultural sector in keeping those soils in the ground and maintaining their sustainability, but also then providing additional benefits in some places through flood risk management and water storage and wildfire management as well. So there are a whole host of benefits we can achieve through working and improving the condition of our peat.
Okay, I'm going to come back to that because there's some interesting points there. In terms of the 2% that you mentioned, can I just clarify, is that 2% of the proportion attributed to agriculture or 2% of the entire national number?
It's 2% of the entire national number.
Okay, so yeah. Pretty significant.
Yeah, there's a lot to try and reduce. Specifically, 88% of those peat emissions come from lowland areas. So that in itself is just under more or less 2% of emissions come from lowland areas in England. There is a particular challenge in those areas to try and reduce that number where we can.
Sure, yeah, because if it is higher than it should be, major problems or contribution to more emissions than we would like. But also, hopefully, the other side of that coin is that if we get it right and management is done in a way to tackle that, it can have a really significant positive impact.
Yeah, absolutely. There is a challenge, as you say. There are lots of things to consider, but there are also lots of benefits to be had if we can get it right and deliver on multiple outcomes, which is obviously a very exciting proposition.
Yeah, definitely. You mentioned a few of the other benefits as well in terms of water management, flood management, and presumably also opportunities to preserve and promote particularly special ecosystems, and that there are specific species that rely on habitat that then also relies on peatland. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. So peatland habitats are generally their natural state or near natural state, and there are a lot of specialist species that do rely on those habitats. If you're thinking about kind of plant species, you've got specialists such as carnivorous plants like sundew. You'll typically find kind of bog mosses like sphagnum, probably more so in the uplands, but then reeds such as typha are quite common in areas such as the Broad. And they're key habitats and key plant species that support a whole host of invertebrates and wildlife as well. So you've got various species of butterfly that heavily rely on wetland habitats, but then obviously also you've got your wading birds and such, so curlew and lapwing as well. And then typically in the watercourses as well, the freshwater habitat elements of these areas, you'll find eels and various other species of fish as well. It's not just the land-based species that you'd perhaps typically think of. There's also the whole freshwater habitat element as well associated with that. Big opportunity to support some of those species that are also sadly in decline at the moment. Another big reason to try and think about it a bit more.
Sure. Yeah. And we know, lucky enough to work with lots of farmers in my role with Farm Goodbye Service, who have to run a resilient business, but also are really switched on and have the joy of working on the land in areas where they're taking care of their natural habitats, and they get the personal benefit as well as the wider societal benefit of being custodians of that habitat and the species that it supports. So hopefully some of those people will be listening today and think, oh yeah, I've got all of those things on my farm. And it's brilliant. The thing that immediately sprang to mind while you're describing all of that, two things. One, that sounds brilliant. I should get out on that kind of habitat more at the weekends. There's also lots of nature reserves and areas where people can access it as a public right of way. But potentially quite challenging if you are also trying to either manage it for livestock, as you mentioned, or grow crops on that kind of land. My understanding is generally peatland is nutrient rich and great for growing crops under certain management, but presumably there's also quite a fine line between what works well for cropping, whether that's grassland or crops, and what actually retains the health of the peat from perspective of carbon capture and all the things we've just spoken about.
Yeah, it is a very fine balance, and trying to achieve all of those different outcomes on what is very little land, essentially, in this country, in England, as well as if you're talking specifically around peat soils, there's an awful lot we need to try and achieve on a very limited amount of land. So getting as many benefits and as many ecosystem services out of one piece of land as possible will be really key going forward. In terms of those peat soils, you're absolutely right. They're incredibly fertile and support an incredibly vast food production and agricultural sector, and of course all of the kind of jobs and supply chains that revolve around that as well. There is absolutely the need to support that food production going forward, but then obviously we have these legally binding targets to reduce emissions as well, plus all of the kind of biodiversity commitments, etc. Yeah, trying to balance that. And yeah, it's in order to do that most effectively, there we need to foster an approach that builds all of those different elements into the landscape, and trying to create a mosaic, if you like, where you have natural habitat right next door to wetter farming, perhaps right next door to some more traditional agriculture, to try and balance all of those different outcomes in the landscape. And that's something that we're really trying to integrate into the landscape and encourage where we can.
Okay, so is that generally the best practice approach, is mosaic farming, if we can call it that? Is it that there needs to be drainage in order to have a productive crop on peatland? I feel like that might be the wrong thing to say, because inherently it feels like drainage to peatland is probably a bad thing. But I also don't know if there are crops that can produce a product on peatland, if there is livestock that can operate on peatland without either sinking or having other kind of welfare issues. Appreciate that arable and livestock are two quite different things. So I'll ask a more straightforward question, which is, what kind of arable farming can you do sustainably on peatland?
That is a good question. There is, historically, you're right, the peat soils have been drained to support that kind of highly productive agriculture. But going in hand with that is the kind of the carbon loss and the land subsidence that we've seen over the last few hundred years. The evidence currently suggests that higher water table management is the way to go to slow that land subsidence, to slow those emissions. But in doing so, that obviously presents challenges to what you can grow, because certain crops won't enjoy higher water tables. So there's a careful balance between managing that water table at, say, 50 centimeters below the surface of the land and identifying what crops grow best in that. But then to get the best emissions reductions, you're probably looking at water tables around 10 to 20 centimeters below the surface, which obviously require you to grow probably a whole new set of crops to what is traditionally grown currently on peat soils. And we're talking a world of polluter culture, which is where you grow specialized wetland species that are harvestable and that have a market or an end product that then people will buy, and hence supporting that kind of viable farm business going forward. It's a tough challenge to get that balance right, but there is ongoing research into what crops grow best in what water tables and what the kind of opportunities going forward might be. But yeah, it's a careful balance, really.
And with that, polluticulture is a new term for me. I did look it up before we had this call, so that I had some idea. And it turns out I have worked in that area. I just didn't know that's what it was called in terms of, correct me if I'm wrong, some of the crops that might be suitable are more likely to be energy crops rather than something that produces food. Is that fair?
Yeah, there is a long list of crops that are being investigated and experimented. Polluticulture, some of those are, as you say, not food crops specifically. So you've got things like sphagnum and typha, which can be used for things like building materials or insulation, things like that. But then there are a host of potential food crops, some of which we're a bit more familiar with. So things like blueberries and celery. But then there are also probably some slightly more experimental things or things that don't yet have as a established market as those I've just mentioned. There is work to be done to build up those markets so that there is a marketable end product from these, and that obviously then supports those farm businesses. Alongside that, the Lowland Agricultural Peat Task Force I mentioned right at the beginning, there was a polluticulture roadmap, and that set out 10 years of how we hope the polluticulture market can grow and include some of those crops and finance mechanisms, etc., that can support that.
Okay, thank you. And I, for the benefit of the listeners, I will pull those links out if they're publicly available and put them in the podcast description. So if anybody wants to go away and have a look at that in a little bit more detail, we can signpost those to the right places. Okay, so some opportunities for productive farming on peatland, which is good, but potentially more restricted. And the further down the line you go to the environmental sustainability piece for peatland in this instance, the potentially less opportunity for profitability. However, we also know that there are various public money for public goods options that support farmers and land managers who are farming in areas that have a real significant environmental benefit potential. You've already mentioned a couple, but I'm going to come back to those if that's okay. Some of the government funded ones, and then we'll just maybe touch on some of the non-government funded opportunities as well. Can we start with the agri-environment schemes, please?
Yeah, the kind of main mechanism to support environmental delivery that DEFRA are offering is through environmental land management schemes. So things like soil testing, cover cropping that will be compatible with sustainable management on peat soils, but are also applicable to the large majority of farmers across the country. You've then got countryside stewardship higher tier, which pays for more specific actions and often more complex actions. So within that, there are four options to raise water levels on lowland peat soils to varying different heights and on grassland and on arable soils, and managing that throughout the year, primarily to reduce emissions, but also deliver all the other benefits that we've already spoken about. And so there's within those, there are two new options with competitive payment rates compared to farming currently. Obviously, that depends on what you grow and where you are in the country, but they are some of the more higher paying countryside stewardship options. But then if you go one step further and you're looking to restore your peat back to natural habitat where that's possible, there's also options to restore fen habitats and raised bog habitats and things like that within countryside stewardship in both the lowlands and the uplands.
Sure. Thank you. Yeah. At the point of recording, people listening to this a little bit later on, we're recording this at the end of March 2025. And as Jordan's mentioned, there's a pause on applications for those. We are expecting some of them to open countryside stewardship higher tier in particular over the summer. And I know that DEFRA did put out a blog on that beginning of the month with some useful information on how people can prepare the invitations for those, the Countryside Stewardship higher tier going out. So it's a rolling invitation process at the moment. And if people are interested in looking at what their options might be and getting their ducks in a row, pun intended, to prepare for an application, then again, I can link that through at the bottom of the podcast description. So that's government funded schemes. We've obviously been talking about carbon sequestration earlier on in the podcast. And the thing that might have immediately sprung into some people's minds is the ongoing development of a carbon credit market, if that's the term to use, as well as potentially some other funded opportunities under things like payments for natural capital. Appreciate that might not be your specialism as you sit within DEFRA, but are you able to give us any kind of overview on how those work?
Yeah, a little bit. So there is, as you say, long-term opportunities for bringing in other finance that's not government funded. So the primary mechanism for doing that on peat soils at the moment, and particularly for peatland restoration, is through the Peatland Code, which is the kind of voluntary standard for UK peatland carbon finance projects. And that essentially aims to bring in investment that can then support those peatland restoration projects. They're constantly asking for more evidence to update that code to make it as robust as it can possibly be. And so I'd certainly point people towards that in the first instance. But then there is ongoing work around things like biodiversity credits, etc., and a whole market outside of government as well that is developing around encouraging private investment into environmental projects such as peatland restoration. So I know that various organizations have had their own funds and have set up initiatives to encourage that kind of green finance. And then there's also responsibilities on certain organizations. So in particular, water companies are bound by the price review to support environmental outcomes, which benefits their customers as well. There is a whole world out there of initiatives going on to generate private investment that complements those funds that we were just talking about. And that is always in development, and I think will be for some time.
Good stuff. Okay, thank you. And yeah, we'll various links on the Farm Advice Service webpage. And again, I'll put anything that I think might be of interest and relevance to people in the description if they want to go and have a little bit of a further look. Okay, I think that we are coming to the close of the podcast now. Thank you very much, Jordan, for your time today. The thing that I usually ask of guests on the podcast, is there one takeaway that you would like people to take away from listening to the podcast, either a thought or an action or something to follow up and look into if they've found what they've listened today to be interesting?
I think the key message is probably collaboration generally. I think it's very difficult to do any of the actions that we've been talking around on your own. There is a chance that your neighbours will be affected or that you're going to need licences or permits or funding. And that obviously requires you to talk to various different organisations and people. And I think that will be key to fostering that and supporting those kind of collaborative groups. And so if anyone's thinking about doing any kind of actions on their peat, I would strongly recommend they talk to their Natural England advisor or their local wildlife organization or their local farming group, because there is a growing community out there and there is a lot of information and a lot of research out there that people can use and can apply to their land. So I would certainly encourage people to go out and talk to people in their area about this, because particularly in those PT areas, that there are lots of trials and case studies going on that people can look towards. So do reach out to your local advisors or indeed DEFRA, and we can absolutely facilitate more of that
stuff. Yeah, I know that if you're looking for a Countryside Stewardship high tier application, for example, that you'll have a local advisor from Natural England, and they are operating in an area that has peatland, then they will know what the opportunities are for that, because it is such a high priority. And there are lots of sources of support and information available to people.
If you have been inspired to learn a bit more about peatland management on farm, we also have a technical article which is being published alongside this podcast. You can find that on the website, and I will put a link into the description box. Thank you, Jordan. Thank you to our listeners for your time as well. Please do check out the other episodes in the Farming Advice Service podcast series, which is available on our website and also on Amazon, Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Thanks also to DEFRA, who fund the Farming Advice Service to help farmers and land managers in England understand and meet the legal requirements in English law around certain farming activities to protect people, livestock and the environment. And we also signpost information and guidance to support sustainable land management approaches. You can find information on our events, webinars, technical articles and other online resources at farmingadviceservice.org.uk. The podcast and newsletter team will welcome any feedback and suggestions on what else you want to know more about. So please do email advice@farmingadviceservice.org.uk. And if you would like to keep up with future podcasts, events and news from the Farming Advice Service, you can sign up to receive our monthly newsletter, which is packed full of timely nudges and relevant advice and guidance on the FAS website, farmingadviceservice.org.uk.